This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
Hi there, everybody. This is Dr. Doug Lyle, and we are live. It's Wednesday evening on the date of the third and final presidential debate. And Nate G. is not with us right this minute. He's having a few technical difficulties, so I am going to be on my own flying solo here for a few minutes. And what we had planned to talk about this evening was politics. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at the current political situation. But in order to understand politics, we want to actually take a broader view than people generally do, and that is usually taken in political science classes. What we're going to do is we're going to step back and take a very wide angle, deep historical view of where politics comes about, you know, why it exists, and why it is that we have essentially the political processes and actually positions that we have today. So most political scientists, of course, don't understand this as we would expect. They don't see politics as an issue or as a process that is being orchestrated by the genetic code. Never occurs to them. They don't take biology classes, and they don't think in terms of human behavior as being genetically driven. But evolutionary psychology, of course, has a different view. And so if we were to look at the political process and try to take it back to its roots, this is what we're going to find. The roots of politics start in the Stone Age. And so if we were to go back and to look at a Stone Age environmental situation, what we're going to see is we're going to see a small group of people, maybe 30 or 40 people, that live together. And it is this band of people essentially against the hostile forces of nature. They warn each other against predators, and they help defend each other against that. They help defend each other against starvation by doing food sharing. They also insure each other against tragedy in the ways that friends do across history. But in the Stone Age, it was probably more dramatic and constant than at any other time in history, because you didn't have any market economies, you didn't have any specialists like, doctors, any kind of insurance process. These people essentially survived or died with respect to the resources that were available in that group. So, if we were to look then at what happens within the group, and try to figure out what the roots of politics are. The fundamental roots of politics are about a single dimension, and that dimension is how much we're going to share. So if you think back about what it would look like to be in a small hunter-gatherer group, what we're going to find is that there's going to be a dynamic tension within that group that people are going to be trying to figure out what is optimal for me with respect to how this group's social expectations work with respect to people's expectations about help from other people. So sharing winds up being a very useful process that winds up supporting and thriving human success for the following reason. That if you were let's suppose you are an antelope on the African savanna, you're a Thompson's gazelle. If you stick your foot in a snake hole, your best friend who you've been running alongside for the past 3 years cannot possibly help you. There's really nothing that they can do. So if a cheetah comes and gets you, your quote friend's best option is just to run as fast as he can and get out of there. And so as a result of the inability of your friend to actually give you very much aid, it's going to turn out that that species will be unable to evolve mental structures that will result in close friendships and the possibility of biologically advantageous self-sacrifice. So let's look now at how different it is for human beings, at how humans evolved extraordinary self-sacrificial capabilities because they wind up being in their own best interest. So let's look at this. If you were living on your own in a hostile environment, you would be your personal abilities against the hostile forces of nature. You could have an injury that would be a temporary injury that could be devastating to your prospects for survival. Let's suppose we're looking at a broken leg. So if you were to break your leg, the predators would spot this. You would be unable to secure food. You might have to damage the leg further and very badly just to struggle as much as you possibly could until you probably would get picked off. So as a result, a broken leg would likely mean death, which is what it does mean for most animals. But for human beings, what they were able to do was they were able to evolve friendship mechanisms by which they could insure each other against this kind of tragedy. So if you had a friend, a single friend, then you had this bond between you, psychological bond being driven by the hormone oxytocin, where you care about them and they care about you. And if it turns out that you broke your leg, your friend would not just run along the savanna and bid you goodbye. They care about you and they would stick around and invest some percentage of their likelihood of their own survival in investing in the possibility of you surviving. So the way the math would look like would be this. Your friend might reduce his or her own, likelihood of survival by maybe 5% by eating less and giving you some of what it is that they are gathering, pushing themselves a little bit further, going without sleep as they guard you more vigilantly against predators, reduce their forays into the wild looking for mates and trying to reproduce. In other words, they would impose costs on themselves in order to benefit you. Now let's see why this would make sense and how it could possibly evolve. Let's suppose that they reduce their own likelihood of survival by 5%, but they increase your likelihood of survival by 50%. So let's say there was a close to a 50-50 chance that you would have been dead had they not aided you, but there's a nearly 100% chance that you'll survive if they do spend their 5% in order to increase your likelihood of survival. This means that there has been an extraordinary biological profit here. So there's been a 10-to-1 payoff in terms of the total net benefit of this behavior. The problem is that the benefit is had by you, not by them. So how it is that nature could get them to be willing to extend you that credit, to extend you the credit of a 5% chance of their own death, how that could evolve is very problematic. So what obviously evolved one little tiny bit at a time. So at first, people may have extended each other a 1% benefit in for some degree of increased likelihood of survival. So maybe the friend gave a little bit of benefit in order to increase your likelihood of survival by 10%. So they didn't care that much about you, but they did extend themselves a little bit. If that worked, and the only reason that would work was number one, of course, their behavior will work for you, but the question is whether or not it works for them. So what's going to happen is the ability for this to evolve depends upon your willingness to reciprocate when the shoe is on the other foot. So the question is there a greater than 1% net benefit to them for the 1% benefit that they are extending you to increase your likelihood of survival? It's going to turn out that this is exactly what did happen in our species. In other words, it wound up being very advantageous for human beings to extend themselves to increase the statistical likelihood of people close to them surviving. This is the roots of self-sacrifice, and this the roots of the self-sacrifice are being generated by a ruthless mathematical program that essentially says that self-sacrificial behavior under certain conditions is well worth it to the person who's doing the self-sacrificing. Now, fast forward away from a single condition where there's two friends in the woods, and now we're going to do something else. We're going to turn them into 10 friends. So we're going to have a little village. So now think about how advantageous it is for a little village. If one person breaks their leg and reduces their otherwise likelihood of survival by 50% if they were on their own, but now they have 10 friends. And as a result of having 10 friends, the 10 friends do not need to each reduce their own likelihood of survival by 5%. We can divide that 5% by 10 because there's 10 people. So now these 10 people each pitch in a tiny little bit, and they risk about a half of a percent of their own likelihood of survival in order to increase the likelihood of your survival by 50%. So the total cost is a 5% total cost, 10 people times a half a percent, and the total benefit is you have a statistical likelihood of survival increase 50%. It's the same 10-to-1 payoff, which is a fantastic payoff, but it's going to turn out that we distribute that risk among a larger group of people. Now, this is an important principle about why it is that human beings evolved in groups and why it is that the nature of that group process in people is to have caring for other individuals. And behind this, what we're going to see, that human beings actually develop what we're going to call empathy. And empathy is going to be something that you're going to very rarely see in the animal kingdom, and you're going to see it in very limited degrees. But in humans, it has absolutely reached its evolutionary apex. Human beings can watch a movie of people that they've never met and that they don't know, and those people go through processes on the screen of substantial losses, and they feel empathy, like they want to be helpful towards those people. This shows you just how deep this runs in the species, which doesn't mean that we are this great, wonderful, you know, beautiful creation where this happens. What it shows you is the engineering of a novel, successful biological concept, and that concept is insurance. So it's going to turn out that insurance is so useful and so important in the world that as soon as we were able to make it into third-party transactions between individuals that don't even know or care about each other, it winds up being 15% of the world's economy. So insurance is a large portion of your own personal life's budget right now, and that's because of its extraordinary value. Okay, so if you drive a car now, you have the possibility of being badly injured by someone else who's driving another car, badly injuring somebody else, having great damage to your own vehicle that would be expensive. You essentially reduce the net possibility of all those risks, and behind those, behind your insurance policy that costs you, you know, maybe a few percent of your annual income or less, behind that, you're able to drive that vehicle, and behind that stands, you know, people with extraordinary capabilities at medicine, at emergency medicine, to actually help you and other people survive should there be a tragedy as a result of using that automobile. That is something that no other animal in the world could pull off. They could never pull off an insurance system, and they couldn't do it because they did not evolve these empathy mechanisms that would result in the non-kin helping behavior that you see in human beings. Now, it turns out that this is the roots of politics. So it sounds good that we would help other people if they're in trouble. But the question is, who should we be helping? And how much should we be helping them? And to what degree should we go forth with behavior that is costly to ourselves? And so in the Stone Age village, it's going to turn out that these questions are of paramount importance, and the village will have disputes on these issues as to how much helping there should be going on, and who should be doing the helping, and what should they be getting in return for it, et cetera, as you would expect, because this behavior, helping behavior and insurance behavior, is not free. It's expensive, and therefore you would expect that there would be some disputes, horse trading, misunderstandings, and differences of perspective as to how this should take place. This, folks, is the roots of politics. So in the Stone Age, there's going to be a problem that the village is trying to solve. And the problem is as follows. A group of people, so let's say in principle, let's keep it very simple. Let's suppose it's 10. So we have 10 people in the village, and we're going to act for a moment like we don't even have men or women. We're just going to look at these as organisms. So you have 10 people in the village. And the problem is that they are trying to insure themselves against problems. And what we're going to do for the moment is we're going to eliminate accidents. So we're going to forget about the idea of broken legs and short-term temporary altruistic behavior on the part of one person in order to help the other person through this tragedy. We're going to set that aside, and we're going to look at a different problem, a problem that was recurrent and is recurrent even in Stone Age villages today. And that's the problem of cowries. So the first place that human beings probably evolved the kind of helping behavior that is characteristic of our species almost certainly had to do with hunting. So it's going to turn out that hunting is going to be one of these behaviors that is going to be it's going to be feast and famine. So there's going to be a situation where a guy makes a kill, and that kill might have a tremendous amount of calories. It might have more calories than he needs that he can actually use. It might be enough calories for a month. But the food is going to spoil. There's no way to preserve it. So in this case, what's going to happen is he needs to figure out, is there some possibility for him to get any use out of this kill beyond what it is that he can use for his own caloric benefit? And it's going to turn out that there is a use for that. And the use is going to be feeding somebody else that has been less fortunate at this time period with respect to their own kill. So you can imagine, if we could, in your own mind, think of 10 men and just forget about women, or you could think that each of these men has a little family where there's a woman and children. That's more realistic. But I want you to think about the psychology of 10 men who are hunters in a hunter-gatherer tribe. Now, let's suppose that each of these men needs to make, on average, 2 kills a week. And let's suppose that, on average, these men are actually better than that. So they're not teetering right on the edge. That the average guy makes about 2.5 kills a week, but he needs 2 kills a week to feed himself and his family. So there is a net excess amount of calories in the village being generated by these hunters on average. Again, we're going to get rid of the concept of somebody going down with an injury. We're just going to say that, okay, on average, this village is churning out 2.5 kills times 10 people, 25 kills a week, and they need 20 kills a week. Now, instead of a typical animal that makes its own kill and eats it, these are going to be humans, and they're going to insure each other against trouble. So let's suppose that we have one individual. We're going to call him, Big Pete, okay? So Big Pete has the ability, typically, to make 4 kills a week. He can make more kills than he needs. And we're going to have another little guy named Little Stu, okay? And Little Stu typically makes 1 kill a week. So Big Pete is going to consistently outproduce what his needs are. The needs of the village are for him to produce about 2. He produces about 4. And so between the two of them, they produce 2.5 kills a week on average. But Pete is a net hunting producer, and Little Stu's in trouble. He actually is not successful enough for him to survive. Now, what's interesting about this is that Pete does not kill 4 kills a week. Sometimes he gets 6. Sometimes he gets 2. Sometimes he gets 0. Sometimes he gets 10. Okay? We don't know. All we know that on average, this guy is very good and he gets 4 kills a week. Little Stu also does not always get 1 kill. Very often he may get 0, but sometimes he may get 3. And so as a result, he also has variance with respect to his abilities. Now, this being the case, what's going to happen here is as follows. That Big Pete is very often going to be subsidizing Little Stu. So he's got 2 extra kills, typically in a given week. In a given week, he has 4 kills, he needs 2. Little Stu has 1 kill, and he needs 2. So Big Pete goes and hands a kill over to Little Stu, and therefore it makes certain that Little Stu survives. Now, you might say, well, what's the point of this? Why would he do this? Well, why not do it? He doesn't have anything else necessarily as productive to do with his time as to make sure that Little Stu survives. Little Stu indicates his gratitude. He says, thank you, which is going to be Stone Age talk for saying that I owe you. So in this way, Big Pete gets a signal from Little Stu that essentially says that Big Pete has credit with Little Stu and that Little Stu recognizes that Big Pete is very valuable, and therefore you can bet that if Big Pete gets into trouble, Little Stu, if he can, will attempt to keep Big Pete alive. Not because he owes him and not because he loves him or he admires him, but simply because Big Pete is extremely valuable and has demonstrated a willingness to share that capability with Little Stu. So we can forget about any warmth about the feelings, but of course there are feelings here that are driving feelings very consistent with exactly what we would expect. But if you think about these as machines, if you think about them as automatons with behavioral programs in them, we would expect that Little Stu would be highly motivated to make sure that Big Pete survives. And he's going to let Big Pete actually know this. It's important that he signals this to Big Pete, because if he does not signal that to Big Pete, then Big Pete might choose to invest in somebody else that gives that signal. So it's going to turn out that giving those signals of gratitude is going to be shaped by evolution, and you better not fake it, because if you fake it, if you actually act like you are feeling gratitude but you don't feel gratitude, then it's going to turn out that somebody else is going to be the recipient of somebody else, of Big Pete's favors rather than you. So it's going to turn out that human beings are going to evolve honest gratitude signals and admiration signals for people that help them. Now, so here we have now the situation where Big Pete is going about his business and Little Stu's going about his business, but I think what would be valuable for you to think about is it, as this goes on week after week and month after month and year after year, what would be some things that would be in the heads of these two people with respect to village process? And now we're going to expand this out to 10 people instead of 2. And just for the sake of argument, we're going to say that there are 5 people called the Peets, and all of them average 4 kills a week. And we're going to say there's 5 people called the Little Stews, and they average 1 kill a week. So it's going to be very typical that the Big Peets are almost always subsidizing the Little Stews, and the Little Stews feel gratitude towards this, etc. Now, what is going to evolve here is going to be the Big Peets feeling like that they are overpaying for the insurance that they get from the Little Stews. So it's going to be the case that they're going to be signaling to the Little Stews that the Little Stews ought to be hustling a little bit more, and that they ought to be working harder than they are, and that they ought to be trying to figure out how to be more effective, because it's expensive to insure them against their own incompetence. Okay? It's going to be the case that the Little Stews taking this signal from the Big Peets are going to feel anxious, but they're also likely to feel resentful of these kinds of signals. And so what we're going to find out is when we look at the Stone Age village, we're going to find out that in Stone Age villages that have been examined by anthropologists, that one of the chief central insults that goes on in a Stone Age village today, which obviously has been going on for hundreds of thousands of years, is that the most competent hunters feel that the least competent hunters are lazy. And it's going to turn out that the least competent hunters are going to feel like the most competent hunters are stingy. And those are going to be the two chief insults that are at the heart of strife within Stone Age villages today. Now, this is precisely analogous to the left and right wing in the United States and elsewhere. So when you have democracies, what you have is a group of people who are working together to ensure each other against tragedies. And they are operating under the rule that we don't steal from each other, which is exactly what goes on in a Stone Age village. We're a group, and it's our group against the hostile forces of nature. And so we have agreements that we don't steal each other's food, you don't steal each other's moccasins, and so on and so forth. And we're all on effectively the same general team. We have competitions between us with respect to reproductive successes. But when it comes to some very important things like survival, you know, if I am Big Pete and another person is Little Stu, I am still interested in Little Stu's survival. I do not want him to be compromised. I want him to actually be effective and healthy because he's part of my insurance coalition. And so as a result of that, that's how people in countries feel. They compete with each other for reproductively relevant resources. In other words, they want to be fancy and be able to show off their good genes to possible mates, and they want to essentially provision their children more than other people are provisioning their children, so that their children can have advantages in mating competitions with in the next generation, and so on and so forth. So it's going to turn out that, of course, within the coalition, there's competition. However, there is also cooperation, and so politics is the inevitable uneasy dance that goes on within a village over disputes as to what is a reasonable and fair way to mutually insure each other. And so it's going to turn out that the biggest earning, most competent people in a society are typically going to be resentful against the least competent, least earning people of a society because they see them as effectively net resource costly. In other words, they take more out of the coalition than they put into it, much like Little Stu. However, they are members of the society, and Little Stu has his place and his value to Big Pete. It sort of widens the coalition. It gives stability. The fact that Little Stu is there and healthy gives stability. There could be a day, rarely though it could be, where Little Stu makes three kills and Big Pete made one kill, and Big Pete is short. And so once in a blue moon, Big Pete needs the insurance that comes from having Little Stu there. And so in this way, there is an uneasy dance that is taking place. And what we're going to see in a Stone Age village is we're going to see that these people are going to have very similar views of this situation. They're going to be very close to each other because they're actually looking at a very, very similar adaptive landscape. So Big Pete is not 10 times more competent than Little Stu, and Little Stu is not, you know, essentially he's not completely incompetent, and they are both looking at the same environment, and they are seeing very, very similar adaptive problems. However, we can see that Little Stu sees the environment as considerably more risky and considerably more problematic and more variable with respect to the food supply. So from the standpoint of Little Stu operating in a Stone Age village, he is looking at the food supply as very capricious and very scary, and he's in a great deal of need of insurance that comes from being in the village. Big Pete is actually going to be much less intimidated by the environment. For him, there is variance in the food supply, but the variance is not so scary. So on a bad, you know, on a relatively poor week, he makes three kills. On a very bad week, he makes two kills, but two kills was all he needed. So it would be extremely rare for him to only make one kill out of that environment. And if he did, he's got enough fat stores on him that he would probably survive. In order for Pete to be in trouble, he'd have to be making one kill repetitively. And from his standpoint, that doesn't appear to be very likely. And so he's not feeling very intimidated by his environmental circumstances in the way the little Sue is. Now, in your mind's eye, what you might do is to essentially draw a line segment, just a line horizontally. And on one far side of the line, one on the left end point, you can put high variable food supply. So from the standpoint of the subjective view of an individual, there would be an ecological set of circumstances where they would be seeing the environment as having very high variance in the food supply, which would be a very dangerous situation to live. And because if it hits, you hit a bad period of poor caloric production, you're going to be dead. So high variable food supply is going to be a problem. Now, as we move the line segment to the right, on the far right, we're going to put very stable food supply. Okay, so now we have two different, graphically different ways of an organism analyzing their situation, in this case humans, that you might have an environment that looks very capricious with respect to food supply on the left, and then you have environments in the middle, which seems sort of neither high variance nor low variance, just sort of in the middle and somewhat risky. And then you have an environment on the far right where the food supply seems extremely stable and therefore very, very predictable. Now, it's going to turn out that our hunter-gatherer ancestors saw their environments as very high variable in terms of food supply. So the entire village in their psychology is actually down on the left end of our graph. So I want you to think about this, and then I want you to move a little bit in from the far left and move it a little bit to the right. So we're going to move it one tiny little notch to the right. Now, the little notch to the right, we're going to call that, say, 10% of the way between the very far left end of our line and the very far end of our line. In other words, it's almost to the far left of the graph, but it's not quite. That is going to represent Big Pete. Big Pete sees the environmental caloric variance as more stable than Little Stu. Little Stu is at the very far left of our graph. He's in a lot of anxiety. He sees the world as very capricious, and he understands that he does not have the chops to survive on his own. And so it is very difficult for him to get enough calories, and so he's living in a lot of fear. Big Pete is also living in a reasonable amount of fear because the environment does appear to be pretty capricious, but it's less capricious to him than it is to Little Stu. Now, this graph, as we move to the right and the caloric flow becomes more and more consistent, what we're going to find out is that it's in humans' best interest to start changing their behavior. So at the far left of the graph, the correct decision is going to be what we're going to call share. So it's the right decision for these individuals on the left side of the graph to have communal processes where they reduce each other's exposure to the high variance of the environment by sharing. And this is exactly what you see in Stone Age villages with the Big Pete's and the Little Stews. What they will typically do is the men will go out and hunt, and hunting is a high variable risk-reward ratio for getting food. It's worth it because you can kill an awful lot of calories with one animal, and as a result, you can feed a whole village with one kill if you're lucky. But at the same time, you may not get that kill. So by communally bringing their talents together, men will then kill animals, and then there will be a distribution of the meat throughout the village. Now, you can imagine that in this high-variance environment, there's going to be effectively what you're seeing is something akin to communism. The phrase that describes communism is from each according to his ability, and to each according to his need. This is essentially what is happening in a Stone Age village. That the notion is that if you are very competent, go out and use that competence and bring in as much calories as you can. If it turns out that little Stu needs some of your calories, then you need to keep him alive. And so go ahead and give him those calories. And of course, it's going to turn out that when we really look at these situations, we're going to find out that Big Pete gets the better cut of the meat, that Big Pete gets to brag about the kills, and Little Stu has to choke it down. And it's going to turn out that the women, obviously, are going to value Big Pete more than they are going to be Little Stu, all things being equal. And so as a result, Big Pete is going to be in better reproductive circumstances than Little Stu, and those genes will tend to get reproduced more than Little Stu genes, which of course makes perfect sense. So there are going to be reasons why Big Pete is still going to put out a lot of energy in order to do this, but at the end of the day, this is going to be a community where there's going to be a tremendous amount of sharing. But because Pete is actually at a different location on this graph of high variance versus low variance food supply, Pete's inferences about how much sharing should be going on are very different than Little Stu's. On the left side of the graph, it's going to be share. On the very right side of the graph, we could label it not share. So in situations where the food supply is very stable, so I want you to imagine a farming community where if everybody, that it's so benign, that if everybody simply goes out there and plants their potatoes and their corn, and they pick the fruit off their fruit trees, that everybody can survive. Anybody that's at all competent, if you can chew gum and walk, you can make enough calories out of your farm that you should be fine. In that case, it doesn't make nearly as much sense to have these mutual insurance processes to essentially have a communal situation. What you want at that point is you would want something more akin to laissez-faire capitalism, where people are only going to be helping and sharing with kin. That's pretty much what they're going to do, and they're going to essentially not want to share with the rest of the group. Now, no such environment exists. In other words, you don't have a situation where everybody in a local environment feels completely that the food supply is stable, that there's no Attila the Hun that's going to attack us and take our food and our women, etc. So in other words, you're going to find that all human societies will picture themselves, and every member of a human society pictures themselves somewhere in this situation from the far left to the far right. Just by accident, I happen to label these on the left and the right of these graphs, and it just turns out coincidentally, that's what we happen to call it today. The right side of the graph is not share. Those are the far right Republicans. On the far left of the graph, this is going to be your communists, your far left sort of interventionist Democrats. So these are the far endpoints, the total conceptual projections of where these two views of how much sharing and mutually insuring that a society should be doing. Now, it's going to turn out that individuals have a tendency to think that their political position is correct, and it's going to turn out that they are sometimes incensed and very disturbed by other people's opinions about what is, quote, correct and what would be right and what would be fair. Now, it's going to turn out that, of course, the reasons for this is going to be that the individuals themselves are going to largely differ tremendously about their inferences about how high variable their environment is with respect to food versus how stable it is. So if you come from an environment where you've never missed a meal, there's been nothing other than a steady food supply, and that you can't really imagine any threat to that, then you're going to have very little incentive to be thinking about how you should be sharing. And the fact that the government that you live under is going to be essentially forcing you to share quite a bit of your income is going to be very irritating, and you are going to look at people who have a more variable resource base than you, i.e. people that don't do as well as you financially, and you are going to see them as essentially little Stews that are taking more than they're worth often, and you're going to be very irritated with them, and you're thinking that they should be working harder and that they're lazy. On the other hand, if you happen to be on the left side of the graph, that you find the market processes in front of you very challenging and difficult, that you see the food supply is effectively highly variable and threatening, you are going to look at people with greater means than you, and you're going to be resentful, and you're going to feel like that they are not sharing nearly enough, and you're going to consider them very stingy, okay? And so this is effectively the difference between the left and the right wing today. Now, there are other issues that color American politics. So you have novel issues like abortion and whether or not that should be legal and under what circumstances, et cetera. And you have other issues about, you know, global warming and how we ought to be thinking about that and what should be done. And, you know, what should we do about the pollution in the rivers and how much, you know, carbon dioxide or monoxide or anything else ought to be allowed with respect to what kinds of production. You have all sorts of issues that get piled onto here that have often completely atheoretical roots to who wound up where in terms of a political party on what issue. However, there is one fundamental issue that stays the same. And the fundamental issue is there's always a party that wants to take resources from the well-to-do members of the society and redistribute those resources to people that have lesser means. And there are people that want to do less of that redistribution and keep more of the resources that they earn and not give to people of lesser means. Now, you might say, well, what's right? You know, is there a right position? It turns out there is not a right position, because we are no longer living in a Stone Age village where we're all looking at essentially the same ecological problems, and that we have very, very similar abilities, that we can look close hand at how hard everybody's working and figure out how much sharing we need to do that optimizes our own best interests. We no longer live in that situation. So I want you to consider our little graph and consider that at the far left of the graph, between the very far left, which is Little Stew, and then a little inch in from there is going to be Big Pete. Those people, those two people who represent the highest income and lowest income earners in that society, those two people are close friends looking at very similar problems, and they are part of a mutual insurance pool, and they all understand what sort of the risk-reward ratios are of their relative situations. Big Pete does not consider Little Stew to be without effort and without some competence and without value, okay? And Little Stew does not consider Big Pete to be anything more than a little bit ornery and a little bit judgmental with respect to his own lack of abilities. He does not see Big Pete as being essentially a glory hog that is that essentially, you know, steals from him in any way. So as a result, these people actually have pretty similar political views. They find themselves at a little bit different location within the Stone Age village, but they are actually looking pretty similarly. Now, what I want you to do is think about this line that we've drawn that goes all the way from high variable food supplies all the way to very, very stable food supplies on the other side. And what I'd like you to do is draw a bell curve where the apex of the bell curve is right in the middle of these two poles. And what we're going to find out when we draw this is that typically in a society, we are no longer looking at food as the variable. We look at all resources as the variable. So people, you know, the left wing talks about how people are starving in America, et cetera, et cetera. This is ludicrous. People are not starving in America. People are overfed in America. If you look at the lowest income people in the United States, their leading cause of death is overconsumption of calories. Okay, so there is absolutely no lack of food in the United States. But that doesn't stop this process from happening. Okay, this process gets widened psychologically, not to food variability, but resource variability. And at that point, what we're going to find is that the difference between Big Pete and Little Stew with respect to resources in the Stone Age was very, very small. Those people had very, very similar resources. Today, the difference between somebody on the lowest end of our society versus the highest end of our society is an absolutely extraordinary, completely unnatural difference in the staggering amount of resource differences that they have. They literally have more than a billion to one differences in resources. Okay, so it's going to turn out that with a millions to one potentially, and certainly very often thousands to one difference, that these people are actually located psychologically at very different places on this bell curve. That so instead of being close to each other, the people on the far right are way over in the capitalistic arena, essentially saying, let's not share. The people on the far left are in a much more Stone Age kind of a mentality, saying, absolutely, we should share tremendously. Look at the enormous, you know, stress that I have with far less resources than other people. It's going to turn out that in our society, what we have decided collectively among 300 million people is that we believe that the, quote, the closest thing to the truth is somewhere in the middle. So if you actually think about where the society is, you're going to turn out that it's right down the center, that the psychological epicenter of the United States politically is that people sort of think it's about right, and that the average person feels like it's pretty close. Okay, you can see this by if you track how it is that we elect our officials. We elect about half Republicans and about half Democrats, which tells you that the psychological epicenter is very, very close to the middle of these two concepts. And what I want to then further point out is that the Democrats are actually, they must locate their ideological position halfway between the middle of the graph and way over on the far left of the graph. That is where they are. They're essentially what you would call that, say, the 25th percentile. That is where they have to be ideologically. So ideologically, they are very much solidly on the side of the graph that says there ought to be much more sharing. If you, the Republicans, then have to locate their ideological position halfway between the middle of the graph and the far right. So their ideological position is there should be far less sharing. If you think about this graph, you think about how far these two psychological epicenters are. They are quite far apart. So they represent ideologies about what would be fair that are considerably apart. And as a result, the vitriol that you will see between the two is extraordinary. The Republican or right position sees the left as unbelievably pandering to incompetence and laziness, and is disgusted and wants to cut the government's budget and essentially tighten the belt of the society and get to keep more of their own money. The people on the left see the extraordinary grandiosity of the money on the people on the right, particularly at the high end, and consider it to be grossly unfair and immoral, and believe that it should be absolutely heavily redistributed. Okay, so we see that in the Stone Age, those two individuals have a political problem, but their viewpoints are pretty close because they live in very similar circumstances. Today, we have 300 million people living in diversely different circumstances, and the psychological epicenters of the two positions are very far apart, and as a result, people are talking at each other and actually screaming, and it becomes the ultimate of you are immoral, okay? Both sides see the other side as literally immoral. The average voter doesn't see it that way. They see it down the middle. But this is where we get the never-ending mess that you see in terms of how it is that people look at these problems. So that is the evolution of politics. Okay, now I'm ready for a question.
All right, here we have a caller here.
Yes.
Caller, what's your name?
Nate, can you hear me?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Nate, please, when the genius of Doug Lyle is going on a rant explaining something, never interrupt him just because some idiot calls in.
Well said. Go ahead.
Nate, is it okay if I swear or no?
Go for it. We are not censored here.
Yeah.
I just want to say Doug Lyle is a fucking genius, first of all. Doug, you need to write a book about this relationship stuff because, you know, there's no one out there like you who explains it in the way you do. And what I love about you is you go to the root of it, like in your motivational triad. Why does a chicken cross the road? People say to get to the other side. But why does he want to get to the other side? Just like with and you absolutely destroyed and debunked Sex at Dawn with by Chris Ryan. That's absolutely a brilliant clip. I want to actually cut it out and upload it to YouTube and title it Doug Lyle Destroys Debunks Sex at Dawn. That was brilliant. But my what was my question? I got it here. My question was oh, by the way, on the topic of what's on the show, the politics, Doug already addressed this a few episodes back where he said that the president doesn't really matter all that much. There are some things that the president can do, like as far as executive action, but, you know, so I don't know if anyone remembers that, but it's sure. Still a great show nonetheless. All right, so I'll just get to my question and shut up. My question is, Doug, you talk a lot about people's ratings, which I agree with, and you're absolutely right because it's extremely highly competitive in the world as far as looks and ratings go.
Yes.
But my question is, what did, why did nature allow so many mutations with so-called fives? Because most people aren't nines and tens today.
Right.
Most people are probably like sevens or eights. So why are there essentially, like you said, science doesn't care about people's feelings, so it's kind of harsh, politically incorrect thing to say. But essentially, right. Why are there so many ugly people? How did nature allow that to happen?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. It turns out that the way I look at this, just so that people understand how I look at numbers, I would consider a five to be absolutely average. And then, so I consider five to be at the 50th percentile, a six at the 60th percentile, seven at the 70th. So when I use those numbers, I'm not using them impressionistically. I'm actually using them right down the line statistically. So the average person is a five. And the superb question is, you know, why didn't nature just keep scrubbing away at these mutation problems and wind up with a lot of great looking people? Okay. The answer is that in the nature of reproduction and genetic recombination, the way the organism is defended against radiation, there is going to be mutations in the genetic code, and you can't stop it. Okay. So so essentially, organisms are as perfect as you can make them. And it turns out that, you know, what nature is doing is nature is throwing spaghetti at the wall as fast as it can. And some of that spaghetti is better than others. So so it's going to turn out that the way nature seems to have this thing organized is that the lower mutation loads are going to be far more sexually attractive, and they're going to out-reproduce the higher mutation loads. So the higher mutation load specimens basically take their lousy mutations with them to the grave, and they're gone, okay? And so nature keeps trying to reduce the amount of mutations that would be in a given gene pool, but it gets stopped by the fact that mutations are going to happen spontaneously because there's only a certain degree of fidelity in the reproduction of DNA, and there's also radiation that's constantly pounding away at the DNA, and that's going to cause mutations. So they would call this black rain. In other words, there's always trouble when you are reproducing things. So if you're trying to make cars in Japan, you're trying to make Hondas, you know, you can have unbelievably good stuff, machinery, but somewhere along the line, a little screw doesn't get quite turned right, and it gets vibrated away when it gets transported to Kansas City, and then it turns out that some little part gets loose and you've got a problem in your Honda. So no matter how well you work at this thing, there's going to be mistakes. And so that is why the world is full of fives. There you go.
Awesome.
Okay. Good question. Very good question.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
You bet.
So, Dr. Lyle, can you explain some of the psychology of Donald Trump and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton?
Yes, I don't know a lot. Donald Trump. I can't explain a lot. Donald Trump is a very interesting character. I don't consider Hillary Clinton that interesting. She's a very conventional, very, very smart, political figure, and obviously an extremely competent human being. I don't think anybody would reasonably argue that. Donald Trump is a very novel kind of a figure that is using an argument politically that is rarely used in the United States, but it is used around the world. It's called the foreign hand. And so what Trump, what motivates Trump is anybody's guess. I think he's I find him personally fascinating. And I think that I have no idea. I have sort of I feel like with Hillary Clinton personally, I think you sort of know what it is that you're going to get. And with Donald Trump, you don't know what you're going to get. So, and I think that variance that I see is something that is reflected in a lot of people's feelings. You could get something very, very interesting and potentially beneficial with Trump, or you could get something pretty terrible, like you don't know, okay? And so I think that this is what people are trying to assess, and probably people's risk tolerance with respect to that issue sort of makes for how it is that they may feel towards him. But what is interesting to me, probably the most interesting to me, other than the candidates, has been the strategy. So Clinton's strategy has been the standard political strategy, which is to essentially get. If you're sitting on this this curve that I talk about, and you're sitting at the 25th percentile, which is where the liberal position should be, it should be right in the middle of the far left position and the middle position. That is exactly where you want to be. You actually want to be slightly towards the middle from there, because you want to take one percentile over the midline, and so you're willing to sacrifice a little bit at the far left, because there's more area under the curve at the middle of the graph than there is at the far left, okay? And so as a result, that is the correct position to try to take 51% of the popular vote, or to take the vote, and that would win. At the same time, the Republican view is to try to get just a little bit to the left of the 75th percentile line, so that the person in the middle feels like you're a little closer to them than the person on the left is closer to them. And so this is the game. The game is to make sure that you solidly don't lose the people that are the extremists of you that are nearby you. You don't want to lose those to a third party, but you want to march as close to the middle as you can. Now Trump, despite all of the potential liabilities in his candidacy, he actually marched closer to the center than Clinton did, and he used the technique called the foreign hand. So let me just briefly explain, so this will help people understand why he has been has had the extraordinary popularity he has, despite a lot of other potential liabilities that he has. The Trump has essentially said, this is not the rich against the poor. Hillary's has been absolutely a standard rich against the poor Democratic position. There's no question that this is true. This is in fact the effective responsibility of the Democratic Party is to essentially beat that drum, and that's the drum that they beat. On the other side, the Ronald Reagan right side drum is to say, hey, the government is taking too much, we're sharing too much, you should ought to keep your own money. He blames the government, but really what we mean is less money being redistributed to people that make less than you. So that is the Republican side of the argument. Now, Trump has said, I'm not about rich against the poor. I'm about stopping the foreigners from stealing the money. Okay? This is the foreign hand. And nobody in American politics, to the best of my knowledge, has ever played the foreign hand as brilliantly as Trump has played it. And so when I first saw him last summer, so they were asking him a question, and this guy answered, the problem's China, and he went on about China. And I was amazed that the question didn't have anything to do with China. And then I saw him ask another question, and he went again to China. And so I could see that this guy was going to play the foreign hand. So he's played the foreign hand against China, and he's played it against Mexico, obviously, and he's played it against Muslim. And so he has done this. They have said, oh, this is racist, et cetera. This is not racist. this is it just so happens that, you know, there can be racial issues here, but that is not actually the play. The play is the foreign hand. The play is to say, I'm for the people of America against the outsiders, as opposed to the standard position from the Republican Party of we need to cut back government, i.e. distributions to the poor. So this is a very, very different election, and for that reason, and we will see how it plays out. And so despite what anybody says, this thing is pretty close. And this thing could move either way, and anybody could win. Obviously, Clinton probably has a 70% chance of winning statistically at this point, or if maybe better. But the foreign hand has been a brilliant play. I have no idea whether Trump believes it. I can't imagine that he does. But it is a it was an extraordinary play out of the political playbook, and we are watching it on the world stage. And it's interesting. So that's my look at this thing.
Now, in the previous podcast on Stone Age politics and modern day politics,
yes.
You mentioned that all politicians are basically they lie a lot because they
yes.
have to because they so
sure.
so in you're thinking that Trump may just have mapped this all out
yes.
and just said, okay, I'm going to play this strategy and then go from there.
Yes.
And then, you know, we're learning more about the Clinton corruption and all that stuff and how she's lying. But from what I'm sensing is you're saying this is all normal on both sides.
Yes.
In other words, to kind of lie and corrupt.
Absolutely. Everybody's lying. Everybody is pandering to bases. Everybody is attempting to get just a slightly bigger coalition than the other guy. And you have no idea, you know, necessarily what these people think. But you do know who it is that they are effectively sort of owing in the end, and you know what, it's an interesting game, and I don't consider it to be important at all, just because I see the American Constitution, the American political system, as unbelievably robust, and I see the politics as the evidence would indicate is really quite irrelevant to almost anything in American life. So there would be probably people objecting to that, and I'm not saying it's completely irrelevant. I'm just saying it's largely irrelevant. So if anybody is all upset about what could happen in this election, you need to understand one thing, that the major key to your better future is you. And that's from E. James Rohn, one of the very fine motivational speakers of our time, from Adventures in Achievement. And this is something to keep in mind. No matter who wins, who loses this silly election, the major key to your better future is you. It doesn't have anything to do with Washington.
Yeah, I want to read you a quick excerpt from one of my Facebook friends who's just, you know, been posting every day about the Trump-Clinton saga that we see.
Yes.
And he basically says, so here goes, guys. If you actually vote for Trump to become the president, please be sure to unfriend me. I don't care how long we've known each other or whether you're friend or family. Once you cast that vote, regardless of the election's outcome, we will never have anything to say to one another ever again.
There you go.
So here's a guy who's willing to give up all of his friends, you know, half of his friends and family.
Right.
For this very what he believes is a moral decision.
Yes. Yeah, he's believing it's a moral decision, and he's making a mistake, but it would take a fair amount of education for him to think his way around that. You don't know why somebody is sitting in the position they are seeing in terms of share, not share kind of issues. And a given politician can basically resonate with their personal view, and their personal view is just, you know, could be easily fundamentally different than you. Everybody knows that is old enough to drive a car. Everybody knows that there are people opposite in terms of your position that are very bright, honorable, decent people. It doesn't matter what your position is. There are people that disagree with you vehemently that are superb human beings. That should give you pause. If that doesn't give you pause, you should realize that there are people that agree with you vehemently that are absolute total sleazeballs. Okay? So I don't care where you are on this dimension. You have your own reasons for sort of intuiting what you think is fair. But the truth of the matter is that to think that a person's political beliefs about a given candidate are some kind of litmus test of their character is a really hugely mistaken inference, and it's born of some rather profound ignorance. Well, listen, I think that's enough for one night, but I want to thank the caller. That was wonderful feedback, and it was always a pleasure to hear it. My peacock feathers, perked up a little bit.
I've learned a lesson not to interrupt the genius Dr. Lyle. So.
Yeah, but just to let the – just in keeping with our program, had it been a sultry female voice with a little bit of a French accent, I would have liked it 10 times better, but I really did like it just the way it was.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Lyle. I love that.
Very good. All right, folks. Thank you, Nate.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.